listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening and welcome to Aloud. I feel like we should welcome Plato in like Elijah. In her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Rebecca Goldstein probes some of the deepest issues of our times by allowing us to eavesdrop on Plato as he encounters the modern world. The erudite philosopher debates Google engineers and talk show hosts, tiger moms, and professors of neuroscience. Rebecca Goldstein drops philosophy into the 21st century in a savvy attempt to demonstrate its relevance. She uses her own insights to connect the bigger philosophical issues to the muddle of our everyday lives. I wonder what Plato would say about traffic. We can ask Rebecca tonight. Rebecca Goldstein brings to this project her skills as both a novelist and a philosopher. She's the author of 10 books, among them my favorite, Betraying Spinoza, the Renegade Jew Who Gave Us Modernity, which won the 2006 Koret International Jewish Book Award in Jewish Thought. And when I encountered a statue of Spinoza on a cold day in Amsterdam a couple of winters ago, I felt I knew him thanks to Goldstein's beautiful book. Her latest novel is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. After receiving her PhD in philosophy from Princeton, Rebecca Goldstein returned to Barnard, her alma mater, where she taught courses in philosophy of science, philosophy of mind, philosophy of psychology, the rationalists, the empiricists, and the ancient Greeks. And it was sometime during her tenure at Barnard that, quite to her own surprise, she used a summer vacation to write her first novel, The Mind-Body Problem. In 1996, Goldstein became a MacArthur Fellow, and in awarding her the prize, the MacArthur Foundation described her work in the following words, which I think offers insight into her way of working in Plato at the Googleplex. They said, "Rebecca Goldstein is a writer whose novels and short stories dramatize the concerns of philosophy without sacrificing the demands of imaginative storytelling. Her books tell a compelling story as they describe with wit, compassion, and originality the interaction of mind and heart." And it's appropriate that this evening's program is in the form of a conversation, as that's a form the Greek philosophers favored. And doing the honors tonight as interlocutor is Alex Cohen, who I'm sure you're familiar with as co-host of KPCC's Take Two show. Prior to that, she was the host of KPCC's All Things Considered, and she's had a long and illustrious career in public radio. And though we may not tonight consider how Plato would have fared on roller skates, I must add that between 2003 and 2010, Alex Cohen was a member of the Los Angeles Derby Dolls, skating as Axles of Evil, and that she has co-written an insider's guide to the roller derby called Down and Derby. With that, please welcome Alex Cohen and Rebecca Goldstein. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everybody, for coming out this evening, and my thanks to the Library Foundation of LA for having us both here tonight. I will confess, and let's please just keep it in this room alone, because I do have a reputation to upkeep. I read a lot of books for work, and a lot of times, because of the pace at which I have to read them, I don't read them all. I kind of read them and forget about them, and most of them are pretty easy to read. This book is a monster, and I mean that in the most complimentary terms possible. I've been reading this book for the past 2 months because I didn't want to miss a single word. It is dense, it is smart, it is thought-provoking, it is laugh-out-loud funny, and it is really an honor to be able to speak here with Rebecca live in person tonight. Now, LA is a smart crowd. Folks who show up at the library are smart people. So I figured that most of you probably know the basics of who Plato was. But I thought it'd be good to just start off with a little bit of a refresher course, because there's a lot about him that I think even learned Plato scholars might not know, or philosophy majors might not know. So Rebecca, let's start off with Plato 101. Who was he?
Who was he? That was part of why I wanted to write this book. We don't know an awful lot about Plato. He lived 2,400 years ago. I would argue that he created the field of philosophy as we know it. He was able to... there were other philosophers around in ancient Athens. He was a citizen of ancient Athens. He was an aristocrat born into a powerful political family. And he inherited a certain kind of peculiar question from his mentor, from Socrates, who hung around the agora and buttonholed people, asking them what their lives were about and where they were going and why they were going that way. And Plato, Socrates was executed. He was put on trial by the Athenian democracy in 399 BCE. He was tried on the charges of impiety and corrupting the young. And Plato decided then that he was going to become a philosopher. He actually had thought he would be a dramatist. And he created these dialogues, which are sort of philosophical drama. In fact, some people even think that they were acted out at his academy. He was also the founder of the first European university, the academy, served as the prototype of the university ever since. But we don't know all that much about him because he chose to give himself to us in these forms of these dialogues, which tell us about a lot of his contemporaries, you know, something about Socrates, but not him. And so one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to try to get closer to him, to try to answer the question of who he was, what kind of person was he, and why was he able to do what he did, which was to discover philosophy.
And you write that no philosopher, probably more so than Plato, said, don't even try to approach me as a person. That's kind of the legacy he left. So you must have known getting into this is going to be quite a challenge. And as you write, Plato is many different things to many different people. So yes. Can you talk a little bit about how you approached him? Obviously, you weren't around 2,400 years ago. So how did you approach discovering who he was and who he meant to you?
Right. Well, one thing I wanted to do was Plato didn't come out of a cultural vacuum. He came out of an extraordinary culture, ancient Athens. And I wanted to get as familiar, as intimate a sense of that culture as I possibly could. So I read everything. Reread, you know, starting with the Iliad and the Odyssey, but in all of the tragedy, and just everything that was available, Sophocles, Aeschylus, Euripides, everything. And also the pre-Socratics and Plato over and over and over again. I have the dialogues pretty much memorized, which is why I was able to lift passages out and put them into these contemporary dialogues.
Must have been great at dinner parties, too. I'm imagining you just bringing it up like that.
People were always surprised when I showed up in a chiton. People think they wore togas. That was the Romans. It was a chiton, but it looked like a toga. But it was, I was, a woman obsessed with the Greeks. I went to ancient Athens. I went to Athens.
You went to ancient Athens in your mind.
I did go to ancient Athens. That was actually going there, because you read and you read, but actually physically going there was very important to me. I had what I consider a major insight, standing in the ancient agora, which is where, you know, Socrates would wander around plying his trade, looking up at the Parthenon, this symbol of Athenian greatness, Athenian exceptionalism, and realize what it was like for Socrates to be wandering around there and saying to the Athenians, who took such pride in their culture, that they didn't know what life was about. So to, you know, be there in the shadow of this glory and realize, you know, the physical setting of Socrates' peculiar way of life was, I had a, there was a moment of truth for me.
Hmm. Not only did you transport yourself back to ancient Greece, you came back to the present day, and I think it's safe to say you took Plato right alongside with you. Throughout the book, there are a number of scenarios. We see Plato appearing as an author speaking at the Googleplex. That's the title scenario. He appears giving love advice in an advice column. He gets an MRI at one point. I mean, he runs the gamut. And I think it definitely winds up showing him in a way that you wouldn't get in any other kind of, you know, academic book on him. What was the inspiration for this particular approach of modernizing the philosopher in this way?
Well, of course, he wrote in a dialogue form. I think philosophy is all around us. I hear it all the time in all of our discussions, how to raise our children. I was in New York on my book tour. I'm eavesdropping. I'm in a restaurant. I'm eavesdropping at the next table. And it's, two women talking about what values to give our kids. What should we want from them? To be successful or to be happy or some sort of deeper kind of achievement? And, you know, it took everything to not... Wait a minute,
somebody... Plato would say.
Yes, I've got a chapter on that. Plato at the 92nd Street Y, talking about how to raise your children. It's just all, the whole... science, religion, faith, reason, debate, in which I've been very involved. These are philosophical issues. Should we trust science? Can science tell us everything? Do we need religion? Do we need religion for morality? These are all philosophical issues. And I think I actually have a theory as to why they've sort of burst onto the public sphere again. I think to a certain extent, we're very much like the ancient Greeks, where our culture is much like the culture that had preceded and created the preconditions for philosophy. And so we're quite concerned with philosophy. And so who better to, bring into this, since he discussed these very issues, he formulated them for the first time, than Plato. Also, I wanted to show him how much progress we've made. I don't think Plato has all the answers. I think I start the book by saying, when an author devotes a book to one subject, everybody assumes that author thinks that subject had all the answers. I think Plato made as many mistakes and was as blind as one would expect of a man who lived 2,400 years ago. If we haven't learned anything philosophically since then, then I want to be out of this field. This is a futile field. So I also wanted to bring Plato back to show him how far we've come and how many of his assumptions we've exposed as unexamined assumptions and falsified.
I loved all of these scenarios, but I think my favorite one is the title scenario of Plato at the Googleplex. And just to lay it out for you here, Plato is an author appearing. He's accompanied with his book tour escort, much as you were this evening. And this is right before he's about to give his big talk at the Googleplex. And he is accosted, I think is a safe word to say, by a very eager employee. And it's kind of a wonderful place for him to be because Google is, of course, our knowledge powerhouse today,
exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And of course, Plato was there with his laptop computer. What does he make of the internet? What does he make of technology? How does that fit in with how he feels about knowledge?
Actually, he doesn't come
with
his laptop.
The laptop. Yeah, that's
he gets it there. he gets a Chromebook there. And then he's addicted to it. Then he carries it everywhere. Which it was also very practical for me because I wanted to get him up to speed fast. And so he's Googling everything. And by the end, when I have him in a neuroscience laboratory about to get a brain scan and he gets into a discussion with the neuroscientist, he knows neuroscience inside out. He's taken a MOOC. And he's, so that was very useful. But what does he make of it? Yeah, he's very excited. This is where he first learns about search engines and the internet and the cloud, this abstraction. It's a very Platonic idea. And he's very, very intrigued by this all. The software engineer tries to convince him that ethical questions can be crowdsourced, that you could, in theory, create a search engine, he calls it an ethical answer search engine, acronym EASE, that would answer all ethical questions with ease. And Plato, I was able to use Plato's own reasoning, updated, to knock down, you know, that argument.
And one of my favorite parts of this discussion is at one point, Plato is able to make an analogy between a philosopher and an orthodontist,
yes,
which I love, because I think it's safe to say 2,400 years ago, orthodontia was not yet on the horizon.
No.
So can you spell this out for us? What's the connection there?
But Socrates, at least as Plato presents him, and most of our knowledge of Socrates comes from Plato's presentation of the character of Socrates in the dialogues, as Plato represents him, he's always making kind of homey analogies, and, you know, to farming and to carpentry and to shoemaking. And, you know, he likes very down-to-earth kinds of analogies. And so, you know, I thought, yeah, I'll make a sort of down-to-earth analogy and orthodonture. And Plato in that dialogue believes, as Plato did believe, that we do need a kind of expertise in philosophy, and that, you know, it can't be crowdsourced. And he actually uses what he's learning. He's a very quick study that we've made a lot of progress. You know, he arrives at Mountain View, California, and it's like, what? No slaves? Where are the slaves? The Greeks had slaves. He never thought to, you know, question slaves. Aristotle didn't think to question slaves. So Cheryl, this very down-to-earth media escort, it can flabbergast him with her own ethical knowledge. And so he says, you know, if we just relied on crowdsourcing, how would you people have been able to make this ethical progress? And so, you know, that's part of his argument against crowdsourcing.
She also stumps him with bringing him up to date with the use of pronouns and how we have to talk a little bit about
when
that.
He you know, uses the pronoun, the male pronoun, you know, to, you know, refer to people in general, you know, when the philosopher discovers this, then he, blah, blah, you know, it's never then he or she or then. Well, we all have this awkwardness, right? We don't want to just use the male pronoun. And she tells him, you know, that this is offensive to women's sensibility. That's big news to him. And he's very careful, to the point of being downright annoying.
Yes.
After that, always say he or she, him or her. Yes.
And he never gets flummoxed, right? I mean, because that must have been no slaves. We have to refer to women. That must have been a pretty big jump for him. What made you think that through all of this, because nothing seems to flummox this man.
Yes. I tried, you know, we don't know all that much about Plato, really. We know some things. We can infer some things from his dialogues. But he hides behind his characters. He hides behind the dialogue style. But he created Socrates in a certain sense, that character Socrates. And so I wanted to create Plato, to be as faithful to what I think I can infer about him and what historians have told us about him, but to create a character that I could love. I don't really always love Plato the way I love other philosophers, Spinoza, for example, my favorite.
Got his poster up in the bedroom wall.
Yes. But I tried to create a character who I tried to give him what I take to be the best of the field he created, which is an open-mindedness, a flexibility, a great knowledge, a great intimacy with sadness, because how can you think about human life without knowing about sadness? And he himself had experienced great sadness in losing Socrates. But yet an insatiable sort of curiosity and playfulness and an openness to other points of view. And that is what I take to be philosophy at its best. And a kind of, you know, going with the flow is this is just trying to take it in. Now, this is, I make no claims that this is the way academic philosophy is conducted, but it is what I take to be, you know, the best of the field and the best of the spirit. And that's So that was the kind of character I tried to give, and that's why he's always interested in learning and in changing, modifying his point of view to a certain extent. It still has to stay consistent with the core of Plato.
Rebecca, we are lucky enough to have you here fresh off a visit yourself to the Googleplex. She was just there earlier this week talking about this book, and I'm just curious to find out what the reaction is like when you talk about what Plato would be like at the Googleplex, the Googleplex in Mountain View.
I was surprised. I've been there before. I've given talks there before. And, you know, I found it not so very pleasant because they all had their laptops open and they're just not looking at me. And I need to see people and read their expressions. You know, I'm a professor used to students reading expressions. And so I can be there's a lot of fun made. I make a lot of fun out of the culture of Google and the good part, but also, you know, the elitism of it. And I was really surprised. I guess it was a self-selective group. They were terrific. Some of them had read the book already. A lot of them, okay, this was funny. I've never tweeted. I'm not on Facebook. I've never used any of the social media. My publishers have, you know, been telling me for years I should be doing this. This is the way you have to do it. So my daughter had said, one of my daughters had said to me, "Mom, would you consider tweeting as Plato? I know you're not interested in tweeting as yourself, but would you consider tweeting?" And yes, of course. That was so exciting to tweet as Plato. And, you know, and I have still his voice in my head, so it would be, you know, I could still use that and bring in sections from the dialogues. So
although I would imagine Plato very hard to do in 140 characters or less.
Oh no, you can do it. It's a challenge, but you know, it's interesting. And a lot of them were followers of Plato. It's called it's Plato Book Tour, at Plato Book Tour, and so they were already familiar with the shtick, and so they were great. They're actually great.
One of my other favorite scenarios is one that you mentioned where Plato sits at a parenting panel at an event not like this one held on the East Coast. And he's there with a tiger mom type and a child psychologist who's very worried about all the pressures being put on kids today. And during the course of a very heated debate where I think at times Plato wins converts and also simultaneously kind of gets everyone a little pissed off, it's safe to say, too.
Yes.
He talks about his vision of an ideal society, which I found really fascinating. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah. I mean, part of it is kind of horrifying to us. You know, he has these extreme... So, yes, it's a panel on child rearing. And, his society is one... He doesn't have too much faith in humankind. He doesn't trust human nature very much. He thinks very few people are capable of reason. And, you know, perhaps the trauma of Socrates' death being tried and voted by the Athenian democracy soured him on human nature. But in any case, his view of human nature is not particularly high. And his ideal state is one that's run by philosophers, by the philosopher king, and can use various means of manipulation, the noble lie, to get people to behave rationally. And so this is a very, you know, anti-democratic view. It's he's been accused of being elitist. He's accused there very heavily of being elitist by both of the panelists. He doesn't think that it's only, you know, the very intelligent, the philosophical, the elite who ought to live good lives. But he does think that there are good lives for different sorts of people. And the best society is one in which all the different kinds can flourish. And so the philosophers can flourish, the farmers can flourish, the business people can flourish, the army can flourish. And this is a different kind of flourishing. And what you need at the head are people who are so disinterested, so dispassionate, who so don't want to rule. That's one of his major criteria for being a good ruler, that you don't want to rule. And they're not allowed to own any private property. That they will act for the good of all. And that's, you know, and his sense is that the only way to have rulers who act for the good of all are to have philosophers who really don't want to rule. They don't want the power. They're doing it out of a sense of obligation.
And so what he recommends doing is to kind of create this society where parents would basically give up their children and anonymously raise, they would all just kind of swap, and no one would really know who was raising whose kids. What would be the purpose of that? This is kind of a crazy, fascinating idea.
Yeah, crazy, and you can imagine how the
tiger mom
reacts. I call her the warrior mom, but she's how she reacts to this. Well, you know, he thought that the best society is one in which we all act for each other, and that the passions that divide us should be as erased as possible. And so even sort of family passion, where you only care about your own kids and your own family, should be erased. And so, you know, there would be a great mating season, and people would come together and they would mate. Here's another example of manipulation from on high. The rulers would be, it would seem as if everybody's mating by lot, that they had lots drawn, but in fact, it's all being manipulated by the rulers, that, you know, the ones that they think are going to produce, you know, best offspring will get more chances. You know, it's eugenics, yes, all sorts of things that we have learned in our 2,400 years are very dangerous ideas. But the problem he's trying to solve, how we can overcome our passions and live together, caring for all of us, you know, that still remains a problem. And, you know, he took these very, it's still a problem. He took these very dire, drastic, radical views as to how we might solve it. But it is a general problem. It is a real and genuine problem.
Putting him in this context of being at the Googleplex or speaking at the 92nd Street Y, as you write, in many ways you are breaking all of the traditional academic rules about philosophy, which is you never put philosophy in a historical context.
Yes.
And yet you've done that again and again and again, which,
yes,
I kind of love.
Yes.
I'm curious, you know, what the response, first of all, why is that rule in place? Why is the traditional line of thinking you don't put philosophy in historical context? And second, what the reaction has been like, if there have been philosophy professors across the country tearing their hair out at this?
Yeah, strangely not. But why is that? There is this notion of that, you know, philosophy is this self-enclosed, you know, perfect reasoning, and it's philosophers talking to other philosophers across the millennia. You know, so Socrates spoke to Plato, who spoke to Aristotle, and, you know, and then there was St. Augustine, and then there was St. Aquinas, and then there's Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz and Locke, and they all talk to each other, and it has nothing to do, and they're just pure, you know, they're disembodied, pure reason. And, you know, of course they're not. If you're, you know, they are people, and the problems that they discover, the problems that we choose to devote ourselves to, have something to do with the society that we live in, the culture that we live in. And certainly Plato's discovery of philosophy had everything to do with the Athenian culture and with their preoccupations, which happened to be much like our preoccupations. So it's just a false model. It's a, you know, of philosophers and this pure reason model of philosophers. So, yes, so that is just wrong. And the man, what is also wrong, and I think this is why what I've been fighting, you know, from the very beginning, when I was 26 years old and was, you know, a new assistant professor, and went and did the incredibly stupid thing of publishing a novel, you know, a philosophical novel. But I was, you know, I wasn't tenured yet and have published a novel. It was as if, and I was in a part of philosophy that is very, you know, very serious. There were no women in it yet. There was philosophy of science. And then you go and you publish a sexy novel. It's like you put on a sign saying, I'm not serious. But what I was trying to do then and all through is to, everybody thinks about philosophy, mm-hmm. to bring the expertise of somebody who's devoted their life to philosophy, who's been trained in philosophy, to bring it to the general public. You do something useful with this. We're all thinking about philosophy. Do professional philosophers have anything interesting, important, and helpful to say at large? And so this is just the latest of my, you know, experiments in this. But Plato did it, so like he wrote for his public. They read him in Athens. They knew when he changed his mind. Oh, the reaction of philosophers. So far, so good. We'll see. so far, so good. Four of the philosophers I most respect, three of them gave me wonderful blurbs, and the fourth one gave me a rave review in the Wall Street Journal. So that was... Yeah, we'll see. They're sharpening their knives. It'll come.
Well, even if people don't see the practical implications for philosophy in their own lives, even if people aren't well-versed in Plato and his dialogues, I think there's one term that it's safe to say just about everyone knows, and it's a term that you talk about in this book, Platonic love.
Yes.
And basically, we have all gotten it pretty wrong for many, many years. Can you describe what real Platonic love in his true vision of it, what that meant?
Yeah. So Plato has a lot to say about eros, about erotic love, about romantic love. He has two dialogues devoted to it, the Symposium and the Phaedrus. The Symposium is the one from which we derive our somewhat degraded notion of Platonic love. And in that dialogue, Socrates gives a long speech. It's a very interesting dialogue. Their symposium really means a drinking party. That's what it meant in Athens. And because of Plato's Symposium, it's changed its meaning. But they are all, it's in the middle of a festival. They're all at somebody's house who just won first prize for a play. And it's a bunch of men. Some of them are lovers with each other. And they're all reclining on these couches. And they're so hungover from celebrations, it's been going on a whole week, that they decide they're not going to drink. It's going to be a dry symposium. And they're just going to make speeches to the god of love. And the whole scene is very sexy. And Socrates makes this long speech in which he argues that we should, all of that erotic energy and longing and desire to possess the beauty of these young things, these beautiful young things, all of that energy, which is the desire for beauty, should be sublimated so that we will love higher things that are more beautiful, like mathematics, and the laws of perfect justice in a perfectly just state, and physical nature itself, which is coherent and has, you know, intelligible laws, and finally beauty itself. You know, we should. So now this is all very hard to do, and in the end of the symposium, he has this Alcibiades, who was a larger than life figure in ancient Athens, already dead when Plato wrote his symposium, sort of crash in drunk, and all chaos breaks out. And I think that he's doing that to show, look, if we don't follow the Socratic way and sublimate and, you know, our erotic longings, this chaos will break out. So that's, you know, what he meant by, you know, so Platonic love. But the amazing thing, and this is for me one of the reasons I really love him, and one of the places where I feel I've drawn closer to the real man, is in the Phaedrus, he reverses himself on this. And this is also wonderful. Plato is always ready to reverse himself. And he reverses himself very blatantly. He's showing us that he's changing his mind. He has Socrates first give a speech He's out in the countryside. He's not often out in the countryside outside the city walls, but here he is in this beautiful, lush countryside with a beautiful, lush boy, Phaedrus. And first, Socrates makes a speech against the madness of love, of personal love, of falling in love with somebody. And that's very much, you know, characteristic of Plato. And then he has Socrates say, they get up, they're about to leave, and Socrates says, I've done a terrible thing. I've offended the god Eros. And he makes a completely different speech, completely opposed to the one he just, in favor of the madness of love, of personal love. And it's one of the places in which, even in the English translation, but really in the ancient Greek, the poetry bursts forth. You know, it's passionate, beautiful, lyrical poetry. Perhaps the most beautiful ancient Greek that's come down to us. And so he's in a very strange mood here. There's no place else in the whole corpus that he's like this. So what does somebody like me, a romantic, infer from this? Plato was in love. He was clearly in love when he wrote this. And I think there's even clues in the ancient Greek as to who he was in love with, which is marvelous, you know, to 2,400 years later to come closer to this man. But the other thing that's so wonderful, and what I think is a real philosopher, not an academic, you know, 9-to-5 philosopher, but a real philosopher, is if he was going through this transformative experience, he was going to change his philosophy as well. He was going to change his view. And that is, to me, that's a real philosopher.
And a real good giver of advice, if I might say so, because in the chapter that you talk about all of this, he basically has dropped in as a special guest expert in an advice column, and he's presented with all these different, you know, my boyfriend's, you know, well, why don't you give a couple of examples and how you came up with them? Because yeah. I have to say, especially for someone who was so practical about it, he actually gave some really sound, I think, romantic advice.
I thought so, too. Yeah.
And keep this in mind, by the way, for the question and answer part. If you yes. want love life, love
yes,
advice,
exactly.
as Plato yes. would give it, Rebecca's yes. here for you.
or Plato is here. So I am friends with a professional advice columnist who used to write under the pseudonym Dear Prudence, I think it was Slate.com, Margot Howard. She's the daughter of Ann Lander. She's the niece of Dear Abby. And so what I did is I made up these questions, very modern questions, like I think the first one, I don't know if I should do the first one. I don't know. Okay, I'm going to do the first one. The first one is, you know, this graduate student writes in and says that she's in a very tough field, one of these humanities fields where there are no jobs. She's in a very good place, but we graduate students can use all the help we can get. My professor has offered to be my professor with benefits. I sleep with him, and he helps me get a job. We graduate students can use all the help we can get. We're both involved with other people, so there's no chance of messiness, and he's a man of honor. I'm sure he'll do this. What should I do? Well, the young boy Phaedrus has a similar problem in the Phaedrus. And so, you know, this is something that I knew that Plato would have something to say about. And it was interesting because Margot, you know, I made up these questions, she would answer them and send it to me, and then, you know, and then I would have Plato answer, and Margot would always say, how'd I do, how'd I do? As if, you know, like Plato was the real expert here.
Right.
And sometimes, as in that question, Plato is more liberal in a way than Margot. Margot was, well, you know, we have a name for people who trade sex, you know, for favors. And Plato was, well, if this is really going to get you knowledge, it's okay. But then he has his reasons for thinking that it's not going to get her knowledge. But if it really was going to get her knowledge, that would be okay. Anything for knowledge.
I picture you as you know, talk about Plato with the Googleplex and writing this advice column. I almost see you in all the time that you're working on this book, literally seeing Plato everywhere.
Everywhere.
There's almost, you know, no situation that comes along that you think he can't fit into. I'm curious if at any point you were in a situation, you thought, what would Plato do here? And you were just stumped. Is there a scenario where Plato didn't fit in?
No. No, there is. I mean, there are so many things that he didn't think of, but there are ways that you can find something there. So, for example, where was I? I was at someplace recently, Harvard Bookstore, I think, and somebody said, what would Plato say about capital punishment? And I wasn't sure. But then I thought about it. And this is where tweeting comes in so handy, because I said, regarding question of capital punishment at Harvard Bookstore, Goldstein flubbed it. Here's what I'd say. And it was, there is this amazing passage in one of his very late dialogues, the Timaeus, one of my favorite dialogues. And he says that we tend to think of Plato as being a dualist. He believed there was the body and there was the soul, the disembodied soul. And he often thinks that. But in the Timaeus, he takes that back. He's constantly rethinking his positions, the best of what a philosopher does. And in the Timaeus, he identifies the seat of our thinking as the brain. His student Aristotle said it was the heart. But he said it was the brain. It was the marrow inside the skull. And he says the way this marrow is connected, he doesn't know about nerves, of course, the way the marrow is connected with the marrow in bones, that's how messages are transmitted. That's how when I think, move my hand, I'm able to do it. And he said that, now Plato always, throughout the dialogues, thinks that nobody willingly does evil. Nobody would, when they do evil, they don't realize what they're doing. That's a rather hopeful idea, and maybe Socrates had believed this. And what he says in the Timaeus is that those who do evil have something wrong with their brains. It's an illness. It's a disease. We don't punish people for other diseases. Why do we punish them for having such diseases that cause them to behave evilly? That is such a progressive idea. So I thought, considering this, and I went back, I do know what the answer is to capital punishment. He would be against it. I mean, he would think, we have to punish people in order to change their behavior, to make it undesirable, to get evildoers, people who can't help themselves, off of the street. But I don't think he would go for capital punishment. So there's always some, something that you can try to understand what he might possibly say.
And it's fascinating that he was able to come to all of those conclusions about the brain without an MRI. But at the end of this book, you have him sign up to do a research. He's very excited about the prospect of being able to see his own brain. And this chapter really brings up one of the big issues and big themes here, which is the tension between science and philosophy, which, yes, I know you have a lot to say about. Yes. So can you talk a little bit about that,
yes,
tension?
Yes, and I start the first chapter with that tension, and I end, the book with that tension, with that answer. That Plato might give. I come from a scientific background. I started out in physics, went into philosophy of science, and I mostly hang out with scientists. They're the people I generally hang out with. And what I often hear from them is that philosophy is a waste of time. And in so many times in the history of philosophy, questions start out as philosophical. All of physics and cosmology was once philosophy. And, up until, I think the word science was coined in the 19th century from the Latin for knowledge, scientia. But, up until then, physicists were called natural philosophers. But it's happened time and time again that questions that were first posed by philosophers, finally, the empirical methodology catches up, and then they become scientific questions. And as science progresses, philosophy shrinks, and the end result will be that there will be no philosophical questions whatsoever. And so I have this sort of the fate of philosophy equation. I say a book devoted to Plato has to have at least one equation. And it's as time, t goes to infinity, the set of philosophical questions will go to the null set. There'll just be no more philosophical questions. I think that's false. And I also think that philosophy on its own has made progress. I think that a lot of the presuppositions of science have actually been argued for by philosophers, so they owe us big time. So this is a running theme. This is my answer to some of my scientific friends who are always telling me that you should have stayed in physics. Philosophy is it's just like a holding pen until it's like holding down the fort until the cavalry arrive. And it's a good thing to hold down the fort, but it's the cavalry that's going to save the day, scientists.
In the same chapter, you also discuss the actual practice of writing itself and how Plato felt about it, that he felt in many ways it was a weak thing.
It was, yes. He mistrusted writing. Tells us in the Phaedrus, again, my favorite, one of my favorites, that books are useless, really, and that he wrote with great misgivings. He thought that he worried about things being written down because then it becomes doctrine. It becomes closed off and people want to interpret, what did this philosopher say? What did that philosopher say? And that happened to Aristotle all through the Middle Ages. You know, he was adopted by the Catholic Church and he was the philosopher. And all questions were answered by consulting Aristotle. Excuse me. Plato saw that as a danger, that philosophy has to be thinking, not becoming thoughtless. That was the whole aim here. And so to write something down became a danger. And then you're going to have interpreters and acolytes and all of this. So I think that's also part of the reason why he wrote in the dialogue form, to show that this is the closest approximation to real philosophical activity, which is discussion. One of the ways that philosophy makes progress, and Plato is down with this too, is to bring to the fore those assumptions that we make that are so deep down in our thinking. They so form our entire view of the world and how we stand vis-a-vis the world that we're just not even aware of them. They're just they don't even seem like assumptions. And the only way to bring them to the fore is to have lots of people talking about these deep questions together, and so therefore these different assumptions will clash with each other, and that is that's the proper thing to do. So he wrote with misgivings.
You write in the book on a number of occasions, and you said here tonight in a number of instances, that you didn't necessarily, and you don't necessarily, think that Plato got everything right. In your opinion, what did he get wrong?
Oh, Lord. Well, the theory of forms, oh, gosh, I have very little patience for that. And I think that, this problem, we talk about, this cup and this cup, and they're both cups. And I think I barely even talk about this in the book because I have so little patience for it. But it's, and what is it in virtue of which they are all cups? There must be something, cupness, this other thing, non-spatio-temporal existent thing, cupness that these things are striving to be like. And, it's just, philosophy's come a long way since that stuff. I would say, for me, any kind of mind-body dualism, which he sometimes seems to sign on to, I think that's something that is hard to take seriously at this point, knowing the neuroscience that we do. Not impossible to take seriously, but more and more difficult. He had no notion of individual rights. He was an ethicist. Aristotle was an ethicist. But it was, what would be the good of society? For example, Plato does argue that talented women, their talents should be used. They should be educated just as the men are educated. And we think, and there's good evidence, that when he founded his academy, he had women. He allowed women to study there. This seems incredibly progressive. But it wasn't based on the notion of what this is our right as individuals. You know, you're not doing right by us if you deprive us of this. It was, look, if they have talents, they should give it to the city at large. So the notion of individual rights, it never dawns on him, for example. He says, and this is progressive for his time, that at war, when one Greek city-state is at war with another Greek city-state, and they were constantly at war with each other, you can't treat prisoners of war. The victors can't treat the vanquished, you know, any which way. You can't take them as slaves. You can't rape their women. You can't, you know, raise them to the ground. It never dawns on him that maybe you shouldn't do that to what they call the barbarians, the non-Greeks. So, you know, there is the notion of what is coming to people in virtue of being people is not there in the ancient Greeks. This is really an idea that emerges in the Enlightenment. And so that's one of the things that Plato is constantly being surprised about, that we value humans as much as we do. We could value them a little bit more, but it's an ongoing process.
Of all the scenarios that you have in here, I'm curious, since you finished writing this book, if there are any scenarios that you think, oh, man, that would have been so great if I had only thought to put Plato in this particular instance
in
this book.
Yeah, I had a few, actually, while I was writing the book. There were things I wanted to do, but the book is already long enough. One was to bring him before a committee in Congress about campaign finance reform. He has something to say about that, actually, about the dangers of money influencing politics. And so there's actually quite a lot. And the other thing is, you know, he's a writer on book tour. I have him on cable news with a show I call The Real McCoy. The host is Roy McCoy, but you might hear the voice of somebody else. Bill O'Reilly. Plato does not get very far with Bill O'Reilly, but it's an interesting conversation, I think. I also thought of bringing him to TED to give a TED talk. I've thought about that one a lot, too.
I thought we could maybe, before we move to the question and answer part, as you might recall, the subtitle to this book is Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. And I really was so impressed to find, as I was reading this book, the instances. And honestly, as mundane as the one that hit me, my neighborhood here in Los Angeles was recently embroiled in a very serious, heated debate about whether or not dogs should be allowed at the local park. And I went to the local neighborhood council meeting and found myself getting up and making my position, all this, and I was like, oh my God, it's Plato in the brain. And there was just certain things about knowledge and his way of making an argument. And it really was the most crucial piece of evidence that I could find that, in fact, Plato is everywhere. Philosophy is not going anywhere. But since you put it way more eloquently than I could, I was wondering if you could please read a bit for us here.
Thank you. Oh, wow, that makes me so happy.
And I prevailed, by the way. My side of the argument won, so Plato prevailed.
Yes. When we disagree over whether the 1% really contribute more to society than the 99%, and whether, if they do, their contributions should be recognized in the form of increased privileges or increased obligations, then Plato is there. When we argue over what the role of the state is, whether it is there to protect us or to perfect us, then there is Plato. When we worry about the susceptibility of voters to demagoguery, then there is Plato. When we wonder whether professional thinkers who come out of our universities and our think tanks should have a role to play in statesmanship, or whether their expertise is useless or worse in the practical political sphere, then there is Plato. When we argue over whether ethical truths are inextricably tied to religious truths, then there is Plato. When we wonder whether reason is sufficient or even necessary to guide us through life, or whether there are occasions when we should abandon reason and go with our hearts, then Plato is there. When we ponder the nature of romantic love and whether there is something redemptive or rather wasteful about the amount of attention and energy we're prepared to sacrifice to it, then Plato is there. When we wonder over the nature of great art and whether it is able to teach us truths we can't otherwise know, And there is Plato. When we wonder whether we should instill in our children a discontent with the ordinary so that they will be inspired to be extraordinary, then there is Plato. When we wonder whether there is a real difference between right and wrong, or whether we're just making it up as we go along, then there is Plato. When we wonder how, if we do know the difference between right and wrong, we come to know it, then there is Plato. When we wonder how we can teach the difference between right and wrong to our children, whether it is through storytelling or reason or threats or love, then there is Plato. When we wonder why virtue so often seems to go unrewarded, with good people suffering while bad people prosper and get tenure, then Plato is there. When we wonder whether the scientific image of human as subject to the laws of nature as the computer on which I'm now writing has rendered the grander humanist image of us quaintly obsolete, then there is Plato. When we ponder the moral shape of history, whether mankind is making moral progress or only finding more efficient ways of expressing savagery and ruthless self-regard, then there Plato is. And when we wonder whether we have at last grasped the truth, or ought rather to hear further arguments from the other side, then there, too, always is Plato.
At this point, I'd like to open it up to the floor for any questions that you might have for Rebecca or Plato. Love-related or otherwise. And it looks like we can take our first one right here.
Good evening. Thank you for a lovely conversation so far. I'm a researcher, and I'm doing research about what motivates people to do things that are civic or to take a role in their community life, and what holds them back when they have strong opinions about something but don't necessarily act. And I want to ask kind of a two-part question. On the one hand, I wonder what Plato would say about the state of civic engagement in the U.S. right now, and I wonder what you would say about it.
Mm. Yeah. Plato would probably say it was too high, and I would say it's too low. Right? You know, as I said, he didn't... I tried to make him learn a little bit about the capacities of us for... democracy, and we have a very different kind of democracy than he did. I ought to just parenthetically say that the founders, the American founders, and those who wrote the Constitution were classically trained. They knew their Plato very well, and they knew his criticisms against democracy, and they part of the democracy that they formed was to try to overcome the criticisms of Athenian democracy. I want to read your research when you have published it, because, you know, it seems to me that our engagement is too low, that there's a kind of fatalism, many people who do have very strong opinions, you know, don't become engaged. More importantly, and one of the things that Plato, you know, he starts out being very excited about the possibilities of the internet, that there's this discourse going on, this very wide discourse that people, you don't have to be face to face, you're in chat rooms, you're in blogs, you're answering each other. And one of the things that he becomes, especially when he's on the Real McCoy show, he becomes disillusioned about is that people are not talking to people with whom they disagree. And in fact, blogs, you know, often people share the same assumptions. And even more perniciously for, you know, our democracy, he thinks, and maybe I think so too, that people are getting their news sources from sources that already agree with their point of view. And so, you know, this he sees as a great problem for our engaging together as a society, you know, thinking of the common good. I think he's got a point.
Hi, I haven't read your book yet, I'm sorry to say. But my extremely rudimentary understanding of Plato is that he was an idealist, mm-hmm. a person who believes that ideas precede the material manifestation of the universe. How would he react to the scientific picture that we have of the universe? Does he in the, course of your book?
Yeah. So Plato, you know, rethinks this position. So the theory of forms, in fact, you know, this notion of the ideas, and the world comes into being by participating in these ideal forms, these prototypes, he subjects to robust criticism in his dialogue, the Parmenides. He actually has Socrates being a very young man there instead of an old wise man, and Parmenides, this pre-Socratic philosopher, is the wise one there. And Parmenides subjects the theory of forms, you know, the theory of the ideas, to stringent criticism, which actually anticipates some of the criticism of Aristotle. And it depends how you date the chronology of the dialogues, but the chronology that I favor has him after the Parmenides, which is a fairly late dialogue, never referring to the theory of forms again. And in the Timaeus, which is a late dialogue, it's mathematics which is the gives the intelligibility of the physical world. So Kepler and Galileo in the 17th century, who really, you know, sort of again brought modern science, they rebelled against the Aristotelian system, created really the scientific method, this kind of mathematical description together with empirical observation. They always refer to Plato as the divine Plato. And it's because of the Timaeus, which was actually through the medieval period, the only one of the Platonic dialogues that was read. So I actually feel that the sort of basic intuitions of mathematical physics are sort of laid out there in the Timaeus, that it's mathematics that gives us the key to the coherence, to the laws of nature. And he gives up with the theory of forms there. And it's the same dialogue in which he talks about thinking being in the brain. So he said... It's the key, yes, yeah, and which is, you know, and I think that's why, you know, Kepler and Galileo called him the divine. When Galileo says, you know, the book of nature is written in the great in one language, the language of mathematics. Those who wish to peruse this great book of nature must first learn the language of mathematics. He's paraphrasing something that Plato says in the Timaeus. And so, you know, the interesting thing about Plato is he changes his mind a lot. So when I bring him forward, he's ready, you know, to be instructed by all of the science that we've managed to learn in the 2,400 years since he died.
Question up there.
One further point about science. In scientific arguments nowadays, philosophy is cropping up more and more, particularly in... cosmology, and scientists are fond of saying in reply to a question, that's a meaningless question, such as what happened before the Big Bang? That's a meaningless question. What is outside the universe? That's a meaningless question. Could you say something about how philosophy can help deal with this issue?
Yeah. So, you know, that... Sometimes, you know... So, you know, saying... you know, that things are a meaningless question. This was the shibboleth of the positivists, of the logical positivists. And, you know, scientists have really picked up on the philosophers have moved on beyond logical positivism, but it is still very much entrenched in... actually, that's how I went into philosophy. I was an undergraduate. I was a major in physics, and I had it was this class in quantum mechanics. And, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, and I could... you know, do the stuff, but what did it mean? And every time I would go to my physics professor and say, but what does this mean? What is it telling us about the world out there, he would say, that's a meaningless question. Shut up and calculate. And then finally he said to me, why don't you go talk to the philosophers? And you know, and they didn't think my question was meaningless. And so that was quite good. It was, so, you know, I think it's true that scientists are now, you know, it's a very confusing world that they're giving us right now, and it's very hard to make sense out of. There's a certain tension between our two greatest theories, the ones that we rely on so heavily, relativity theory and quantum mechanics. There's a tension between them that I think there's, in fact, a crisis in physics. String theory, beautiful mathematics. There's no way to make a prediction based on it. Is it science? Isn't it science? They're being forced to think about philosophy. The one favorite philosopher of scientists is Karl Popper, with his notion of falsifiability, that what separates out other theories from true scientific theories is that they make some kind of prediction and that is in principle falsifiable. That science is this ingenious methodology that we've come up with by which when we get the world right, we can get the world to answer us back, and that's what science is. And that was really the idea of Karl Popper. And most of the scientists that I know, that's the only philosopher they think has ever said anything useful. But according to, you know, Popperian falsifiability, it's not clear that, for example, the multiverse is a scientific theory. You know, is that falsifiable? So, anyway, physicists, cosmologists are confronting these philosophical questions more and more, just as you say.
I haven't read your book yet either, so I'm not sure if this is... I'm assuming it's probably part of the Google part, but with media saturation, I mean, just complete media saturation today with the internet, you know, I'm just curious, is there a 2014 update of the Allegory of the Cave? I'm sure it's in there. I'm sure that's like 101, but... I'm curious what that is.
Yes. Of course, the Allegory of the Cave, which is probably the most famous passage in Plato. You know, so these prisoners who are staring at images that are being projected on the back wall of the cave, and he says that that's where most of us are. And this is, of course, a very image-oriented society, but not only. The way in which I see the question of social, you know, media really being relevant to ancient Greece is the ancient Greeks, and this is part of that whole world at that time, were very preoccupied with the question of how to achieve a life that matters. We have a very brief time here on Earth. We don't know most of the people who lived before us. We won't be known after we're gone. Why did we show up for our existence in the first place, right? I mean, it's just, it's so brief. And the Greeks, Greek philosophy emerged at the same time as Greek tragedy. And this is like a preoccupation of the Greeks. You know what? They're pre-monotheistic. We are more and more post-monotheistic. For a long time, monotheism answered this question. You know, there's God. We matter to God. He created the universe for us. Do what he wants. That will give your life meaning, and maybe you'll even get an afterlife, a nice afterlife. And, you know, that kind of answer satisfies us, a lot of us, less and less at this point. And it didn't. That's not how the Greeks approached this problem. They approached the problem, they had gods, but you didn't want the attention of the gods. That's the last thing you wanted, was the attention of the Greek gods, right? Something terrible always happened when the gods paid attention to you, at the very least a rape. And, you know, so... They had all of these rituals, but it was to ward off the attention of the gods. They looked to each other for confirmation that they were living lives of importance. If they were spoken about, if they did something extraordinary, and so if a poet sung of them, this was a kind of immortality, the only kind of immortality for which they hoped. So try to be larger than life. They lived by that. That's why they were so extraordinary. That's why they did so much. So I think with our preoccupation with social media, you know, I go to a restaurant and everybody's taking pictures of their food and posting it on their Facebook, and it's like, look at me, look at, you know, it's like, it's a, or how big my Twitter following is, and, you know, and I watch that, how big it is. You know, these ways of confirmation, of looking to one another for confirmation, you know, that what we do is important, that being mentally replicated in others' minds, like, will give a little more substance, a little moreness to our lives. And so we are falling back very much on the kinds of answers using our social media that parallels the ancient Greeks, and against which Socrates and Plato were rebelling, actually.
I could see him being completely baffled by the concept of a selfie.
Yes.
Plato doesn't do selfies.
You know what? I mean, yes. And, you know, when people ask me on book tour to do a selfie, they're very abashed. And, in fact, sometimes I will get emails saying, I hope you realize that I asked you ironically for the selfie, right? It's still a selfie. But it's okay. I do selfies. I think
if you want. Maybe two more questions. Hi. Two questions. What would...
Okay. Very good.
I'll make it short.
You are quick.
What would Plato say after reading The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand? And two, so in the symposium, the young men are doing some pretty interesting things for their mentors. What would Plato say about doing it in the butt?
Ah. I'm stumped by both of your questions. Very good. I might tweet about it. I'll have to think about it. You know, Ayn Rand, in a certain way, you know, she did believe in the extraordinary. And what were there are the moochers and the creators or something, you know, of this sort. Plato is never interested in... you know, power for the sake of power. And he has a very narrow view of what it is to achieve something extraordinary. And it, you know, it is to have this view of, you know, virtue and justice and to be working for justice, which is, you know, the good of all. His philosopher king is not high on his own power, quite the contrary. His philosopher king would rather be studying mathematics and not have all this power. But because he understands the nature of justice, he is working for the good of all. So, you know, in that sense, I think there's a certain kind of distance from Ayn Rand, but I have to confess that I've never read her. And I've never been able to get through it, actually. And... So I don't, you know, I'm talking through my hat a little bit here, but it is, you know, it's not the extraordinary for the sake of the extraordinary. It's the extraordinary for the sake of all of us. The Greeks did a lot in the nude. They exercised in the nude, and one of the more progressive things that Plato says in the Republic, and he repeats in the Laws, is if we're going to train our women in the same way we train men, we have to allow them to exercise in the nude, even if they're old and ugly. So, you know, but they were quite used to nudity. They did a lot in the nude. So what was your question about in the butt? It was what doing philosophy that way? That would be distracting, I think, yeah. Yes.
Learning from each other.
Yes.
Acknowledger for whose sake. And they did some interesting, it was implied mostly in the symposium, they did some interesting things with each other. Like what would they say about? sexuality,
oh, well, you know what? Plato can be a bit of a prude about various things. You know, it's much better for there to be a commingling of minds than there for to be a commingling of bodily fluids for Plato. I often, one of the things I've thought about, what would he think about, you know, our argument about gay rights? I mean, for him, what would he think about heterosexual rights, really? The highest love is really, for him, between two men, because their women were basically uneducated. So if there is going to be this higher love, this commingling of minds, you know, he basically thought it's going to be between men. So, I mean, he would be just completely baffled about gay rights. Of course, you know, this is the highest form of love, he thinks. So, yeah. And the other thing is, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the Greeks in general, were very... especially the aristocrats, which was the class that he came from, homosexuality was very much the ideal love. Everybody in the symposium takes that for granted, that's the ideal love. And that's interesting about the Greeks. I talk about it in the book, why that might be, that they thought of that as, in general, as the ideal love.
One final question.
Thank you. I was wondering, just to take a step back, how can we get more people like you out of academia and into, you know, I mean, you're taking this role as a public philosopher in a way, you know, Michael Sandel, Peter Singer.
Yes.
How do we encourage that more in from academics?
I don't know.
Cloning.
I don't know. You know, I've been very impressed with the scientists who have stepped up to the plate, you know, and, you know, Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker, and others who have, you know, Brian Greene, who have really written these very accessible books, tried to get people excited by their field, the beauty of their field, to share this. Philosophers often get very grumpy when other people talk about philosophical ideas. I was just with a scientist today who told me, you know, when he talks about philosophy, you know, he gets bad reviews from philosophers. They will, you know, say, you haven't gotten it quite right. So, you know, that just doesn't seem to me to be right. If you think that these questions are important, and if you care that people get them right, then get out there and, you know, and expose yourself. I mean, one of the things is I'm trained in analytic philosophy. We worship precision, and so splitting hairs, and, you know, we worship that, and I think that's very, very important. These are hard questions, and you do want to be as precise as possible. But if you sacrifice substance to precision, if you sacrifice, you know, speaking to people, everybody's interested in philosophy, if you hold back your expertise because you can't speak in with that precision that you can speak with to other philosophers, I think Plato would say, where are your ethical commitments? What let's take seriously what the philosopher owes to society at large. So, I don't know what to do about it except to just do what I do.
I know the question was for Rebecca, but I'm actually going to take that one on as well, because I think one way that you can have more people like Rebecca in this world is events like what we've had tonight. I want to take an opportunity for folks who aren't aware of the LA Library Foundation, of all the great work that they do. This is just one of many conversations that they offer here for free. But much like the institution that I come from, Public Radio and KPCC, they cannot do it without your support. So if you haven't learned yet about the LA Library Foundation, I highly encourage you. They've got staff members who will be there at the library. They are on Twitter, Aloud LA. There's all sorts of great ways you can find out about how to become a member and help to support them so we have more events like this evening. My sincere thanks to both the LA Library.
And let me just say that Plato would want you to do that.
Yes, he would. Thank you so much to Rebecca.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.